Albert Eiler was a renegade even for the 1960s, a modest man with a wild saxophone style that exploded into dense jazz improvisations. His playing foresaw the hardcore punk and alternative rock styles of more recent times. In fact, a new generation of mostly rock fans is discovering Eiler's music thanks to the reissue of the original recording, several tribute CDs, and a new documentary. Howard Mandel prepared this report.
My name is Albert Eiler. I played back when I was about 8 years old. My father, he made me play the saxophone and so forth.
These words open Albert Eiler's 1963 debut, My Name is Albert Eiler. They're also in the new Swedish documentary of the same title.
I had always wanted to come to the Scandinavian countries. I'd heard a lot about the Scandinavian people.
The film's director, Casper Collin, thought there was a good story in the Black American's apprenticeship touring Sweden with dance bands in 1962. The confusion his intense originality prompted for musicians and listeners alike, and his triumphant return to Northern Europe as a headliner with the touring Newport Jazz Festival in 1966. Casper Collin was unsure, though, of how to create a portrait of this musician found floating in New York's East River, evidently a suicide, just 4 years later. Then he discovered some extraordinary footage.
And that is the beautiful shot of Albert naked from his chest and up. It's like a 30 or 40 seconds long shot, but he's just looking into the camera. And he has beautiful, burning eyes. This was in 1998, and I strongly remember when seeing this for the first time. You know, I had been listening to his music for quite a long time, and then seeing him looking at you, it was very, very moving. So I kind of decided then, if this is the only footage, we try to make at least a small film.
Instead of a small film, Collin persisted in his research and came up with a 79-minute movie. He interviewed Eiler's Swedish colleagues and girlfriend, his American collaborators, including drummer Sonny Murray and bassist Gary Peacock, and eventually traveled to Cleveland to meet Eiler's then 89-year-old father and his surviving brother. The film My Name is Albert Eiler depicts a man of pure vision and aesthetic daring, mostly misunderstood in the jazz world, the pride and despair of his family and friends.
I was living pure frustration like a madman, like a madman. I was up in my room when I went to Cleveland playing, and I was beating like this on the floor. Then I go downstairs. My mother said to me, "I don't think you are my child." When I was in the hospital, the man must have made a mistake and give me the wrong baby. Made me cry. I cried, but I thought, I said, nobody understands what music, what I'm trying to do, and I'm trying to understand it. And it was like very shaky situation.
Eiler's mix of ingenuous simplicity and improvisational fervor has found a hard core of fans. Mark Webo, one of the most acclaimed progressive guitarists on the New York scene, comes out of a rock, rhythm and blues, and no-wave background, and asserts that Eiler's language is a jazz beyond jazz.
The chord language of his compositions goes between the tonal language of spirituals, of military marches, and occasionally of blues. It goes between there and pretty dense atonality without ever stopping in between at bebop, let's say.
Mark Webo put together this band called Spiritual Unity to celebrate and transform Eiler's music. Vinnie Golia, a composer and multi-instrumentalist at the center of the Los Angeles post-jazz scene, is one of the voices on another tribute album, Healing Force, the songs of Albert Eiler. Vinnie Golia was a painter, not a musician, when he first heard Albert Eiler in Greenwich Village in the late 1960s. He, too, says Eiler's music has the energy of punk and gospel.
That just sweeps over you, that energy. You don't care if they're playing two chords or what. You know, it's just the energy and the commitment to playing that way.
Albert Eiler's ferocity and commitment do not make for easy listening, but Vinnie Golia says a little effort can open your ears.
That music can lift you up, but there's a point where you become fatigued. And if you can break through that little wall, your listening opens up into this other level, and it really becomes quite astounding. You start to hear the logic, just the intent of how the person is playing. And so that lifts you to this other place, which I find is, man, you know, I mean, it's quite exhilarating, you know, and you want to stay there, not only as a player, but as a listener.
Oh, let it come in. Oh, let it come in.
For most of his career, Albert Eiler was shunned, ridiculed, or ignored. Yet by the time of this 1964 interview, he'd become certain about what he was doing.
The music that we're playing now is just a different kind of blues. It's the real blues. It's the new blues. And the people must listen to this music because they'll be hearing it all the time. Because if it's not me, it'll be someone else that's playing it. Because this is the only way that's left for the musicians to play. All the other ways have been explored.
Eiler's ambitions may be a little closer to realization, says filmmaker Casper Collin.
Maybe he did not really succeed in the way he wanted when he was living, but the interest in his music is much, much bigger today. I think there's a lot of people coming to this kind of music from more alternative rock music. It's not really a jazz thing, really, but I think that there's a lot more open-minded people today.
Collin's faith echoes Eiler's own.
One day, everything will be as it should be.
Until then, the film My Name is Albert Eiler is showing at art houses across the country, tribute projects proliferate, and Eiler's own recordings have been reissued. For NPR News, I'm Howard Mandel in New York.
And you can hear full songs from Albert Eiler and more in the music section of our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
This week's reporting from the city of Karachi has reminded us of one of the realities of traveling abroad. When you're in America, Pakistan seems very far away. When you're in Pakistan, America seems very near. Visit the poorest neighborhood in the most remote part of town, and somebody will have an opinion about American policies. More affluent Pakistanis travel back and forth to the U.S., and one of Pakistan's biggest music stars grew up in America. Salman Ahmad leads the group Janu. You're hearing their music now. His father moved around as an employee of Pakistan International Airlines.
I mean, think about this. I was 11 years old when I came to New York. You know, like millions of other kids who were grown up on Zeppelin and Aerosmith, you know, I wanted to be a rock star. And then to be taken from that place and moved to Pakistan, which was alien to me now.
You went back to Pakistan after high school?
Well, you know, I joined a garage band called Eclipse, and I started playing the guitar 14 hours a day. And my mother, who, like all South Asian mothers, freaked out. And she realized that her dream of seeing her son as a doctor was going to dissipate unless she sent me back to Pakistan. You know, in the middle of a military dictatorship of General Zia, I studied at King Edward Medical College. Pakistan had changed significantly from the 70s, and I landed in the middle of that nightmare.
Salman Ahmad and his friends went to medical school at a time when Pakistan's military government was imposing a more conservative view of Islam.
There was a bunch of us, about 60 of us, who decided that hell with these mullahs. So we decided to hold a talent show, like a gong show. You remember that show?
Sure.
And we kept it very secret. I got up, and the thing I knew how to play was Van Halen's Eruption. And I closed my eyes and I heard this almighty roar. And I thought these kids are loving it. But what had happened was that the jihadis had found out that there was this place of obscenity and vulgarity where girls and guys were sitting together. So they came, covered the girls with burqas and chadars. And one of them came up on stage and he grabbed my cheap copy of my Les Paul, my first guitar I ever had, and he smashed it on the ground. Mm. And first of all, I thought, wait a minute, I was supposed to do that. I mean, And so it made me think, if music bothers these guys so much, I should do more of it, you know?
I don't see lyrics that are overtly political, even though you have become, in some sense, a political figure or at least someone who stands for something.
During that time, those 5 years I was in medical school, I dove into the poetry of the Sufi poets, like Rumi and from the South Asia, Baba Bulleh Shah. And he wrote his first poem, which was, Who Am I? Where he says, if I translate the Punjabi, I'm no believer in a mosque. I have no pagan ways. I'm not pure. I'm not vile. I'm no Moses. I'm no Pharaoh. Who am I?
You took that. You turned that into a song, didn't you?
Yeah. It's on our album, Parvaz, The Flight. That was a big turning point for me. But I wasn't thinking ever of a political, you know, it just became political because we got really big.
Did living in Karachi make you or force you to be more political?
Well, you know, Steve, you just couldn't escape it. You know, you saw such tremendous poverty, plus the violence of Karachi, the day-to-day violence, the sectarian violence, the political violence. I remember when we were doing our album, Inqilab, which means revolution, we'd go to the studio, which is on the other side of town, and, you know, I saw, a political murder in front of my eyes.
Salman Ahmad said he was threatened, too, by members of the MQM. That's the political party that runs Karachi. Its leader is a man we met on this program earlier this week, Altaf Hussein.
It went like this. One of their activists, he called up and he said that Our leader, Altaf Hussein, loves your music, and he would like for you to come and perform at his wedding. And I told him, I said very nicely that I don't, you know, go and play at people's weddings, especially political leaders who are corrupt, like your leader. And so he lost it. And he said, you know, if you want to live in Karachi, you have to deal with the MQM. And by a stroke of good luck for me, ill luck for him, this guy got wiped out by the other faction of the MQM, you know? So, you know, he didn't live long enough to carry out that threat. But that's happened many, many times. That impacted the music in a big way.
In what way?
Well, it made me think, what do I want to say in the music that we sing? And, you know, there's a song called Talash, which is on our second album, which is an overtly political song. I mean, the lyrics, basically that, if I could translate, under burning sun, there's a search for shade. And this is difficult to translate, but literally it says, once we get over the fighting, we'll find our identity.
You know, I'm just thinking about cities that I love, and if I think about New York City, it has also been a very violent place and a grim and unhappy place in many ways, and yet I love the city. Is there something about Karachi that transcends the poverty and the violence that is so obvious there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a spirit of resilience in the city, in the people. You know, you say, well, you know, we're going to face this and no matter what, and we're going to carry on with our lives. Parties, weddings, you know, because there's no, you're not going to say, well, we'll wait for the violence to end so that we can get on with our lives. No, it has to go on at the same time.
That's Salman Ahmad, frontman for the Pakistani rock band Janu. You can find all the stories in our Urban Frontier series at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Karachi, Pakistan.
And I'm Renee Montaigne at NPR West. And Steve will be back home in Washington next week.
Well, now a remembrance of art on the other coast and a generation away. If the Summer of Love had a signature visual, it emerged from the drawing pad of Alton Kelly. Kelly's concert posters and handbills came to define the look of the sound of San Francisco. This week, Alton Kelly, at age 67, died in California of complications from osteoporosis. And NPR's Felix Contreras has this appreciation.
Alton Kelly arrived in Haight-Ashbury in 1964 with a sketchbook full of hot rod drawings. He'd race cars and bikes back home in Connecticut. When Kelly met a fellow hot rod artist from Detroit named Stanley Miller a few years later, cars and motorcycles gave way to skeletons and roses. They started making posters for dance concerts featuring up-and-coming groups like the Grateful Dead, Big Brother and the Holding Company, and Quicksilver Messenger Service. Stanley Miller, who goes by the name Mouse, says the work and good times rolled like a freight train.
Things are really furious and moving really fast. Every day seemed like a year. We knew something was happening, but there wasn't any time to think of what was happening. We just knew that it was wild and woolly, and it was all happening all around us.
Mouse and Kelly were cranking out their elaborate posters once a week. They expanded their portfolio to include album covers. The Grateful Dead liked the skeleton and roses image the pair created for a concert poster so much, the musicians adopted it as their logo.
Saint Stephen with a rose, in and out of the garden he goes.
Some call the art a visual extension of the music. Others call it the visual for a psychedelic experience. Mouse says it was both, and the joke between he and Kelly was that you had to be under the influence to understand it. But the ideas, Mouse says, came from trips to libraries and art galleries. Kelly and Mouse pored over books about Gustav Klimt, Japanese poster art, and Art Nouveau.
One of the great experiences was doing this poster for Big Brother and Jim Kweskin, where we took an Art Nouveau piece from Mucha, and we made it really beautiful with really beautiful colors. I think it was October, and it plastered all over the city and in every store window, every pole.
Today, some of those original posters are worth tens of thousands of dollars. Mouse says he and Alton Kelly developed a work style that allowed them to stand side by side at the same art table.
He was left-handed and I was right-handed, so we could have four arms working at the same time. So we were like a four-armed monster artist.
The pair worked together for over four decades. Mouse says his work routine with Alton Kelly never changed.
I had a secretary and Kelly would come. We were working a lot for about a week, and finally the secretary said, "Don't you guys ever talk?" I guess there was such a great communication thing going between us that we didn't have to talk. We knew what we had to do, and we did it.
Just 5 months ago, Alton Kelly and Stanley Mouse Miller completed their last work together, a poster for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
So, Mike, ever wonder where does the music come from?
It's such an age-old question, locating the inspiration for a song, either from a ditty or a symphony. You know, I believe it was the philosopher Hegel who surmised that the music itself comes from within, that music...
No, I mean the music that you hear on the show. Who's playing the music on the show?
Oh, okay. Sometimes Jacob cues a track and Manoli fires a CD, and other times musicians come into the studio.
Oh, yeah.
And at those times, a lot of effort goes into making piano and strings and singing sound good. This is what it sounds like when the band Mates of State tunes up before they play a song on the BPP. What we're going to do is we're going to give you an extra bonus song live from the BPP studios. This is going to cost some real radio money. Luckily, I have a radio quarter with me here in the studio.
Good.
Going to put it in the old jukebox, and here is Mates of State playing You Are Free live in BPP studios.
Okay.
Last night that we lost the fight. I had telling me the right way to go. I'm on my own. You're selling our old ways. Stop telling me the right way to go. I'm on my own.
That is the band Mates of State performing live on the BPP. You Are Free is from their new album, Rearrange Us.
That does it for this hour of the BPP, but we don't go away. We're online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Rachel Martin.
I happen to be Mike Pesca. I'm not wedded to that identity. It's just who I've chosen today. And this is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. You are